Good morning, good afternoon. My name is Sanam Anderlini. I am the director of the Center for Women, Peace and Security at the London School of Economics and the CEO and founder of the International Civil Society Action Network, ICAN. I'm delighted to host this fifth in our series of the 21 or coming of age of the Women, Peace and Security Agenda 21 in 2021 with guests this week talking about survival and activism under occupation. I'm delighted to have three extraordinary speakers with us. Agnès Callamard, who was recently appointed to as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, formerly the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings. Lucy Talgiad, counselor from in Bethlehem and a founder of the Wa'im Center for peace building and conflict resolution. May Sabah Pei, who is from Myanmar and heads up the Gender Equality Network. The conversation is going to be very informal, as usual, as we do them. We're open to questions in the chat, if you could share them with us, and we will fold them into the discussions as we go forward. And with that, I'm going to get started with the discussions. We have about an hour and 15 minutes. And as I said, well, I welcome questions as we go through, but we will have a flow of the discussions. My first question really to all three of you is, you know, people always wonder, we talk about activists and, you know, social activists, human rights activists. It almost seems like a world apart from the mainstream world and, you know, world sort of that people are in, whether it's private sector or academia or media and so forth. How do you get into this world? What drew you into becoming an activist, and how do you describe yourselves, you know, when you're talking to people? What do your family and friends think about these issues? Lucy, I'm going to start with you. What happened to you? How did you become a peace activist, and what do you call yourself, actually?
Me?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. How I started being or calling myself activist. You know that in Palestine, we are living under occupation. When you live under occupation, under oppression, under a place there is no peace or security, you don't feel it. Either or, you act towards it, or you've been just passive. So I refuse to be a passive, especially at the beginning, taking a lead in activism. My mother was one of those that against me. She said to me, "Lucy, this is not your road. This road full of thorns." Especially the background of my family, that my mother, she lost her dad and brother and sister during the war 67. And she wasn't believing activism as non-violence resistant that time. So she was telling me all the time, "Lucy, with non-violence resistant, you are not going to achieve nothing." So I remember myself, the beginning started almost 3 months, she refused to talk to me. And later on, day by day, when she saw what I'm doing, she became a proud mom with the achievement that I'm doing on the ground. Plus, activism started being as a woman living under patriarchal society. There is no equity. There is no equality. There is no justice for women. So how could I accept these norms? This is not me. So I became revolutionist even at early age. When my mom started to telling me, "Lucy, prepare the food for your brothers," I said, "No, he has hands to do it." So since I'm a child, I was a revolutionist on that field. So simply, activism, what you believe in, you could do. Living under oppression, that helps a lot for you to walk on that way.
Thank you. I'm going to come back to you about the question of what actually daily living under occupation means. May, does that resonate with you? Did your mom also not want you to do what you're doing, or how, what, how do you define your work, and how do you start? How did you start? Can you unmute? Yeah, can you unmute yourself? Are you having trouble? On the LSE side, can we unmute May?
Yeah, May, you just need to accept the request to unmute.
Shall we? Okay, I'll move to Agnes while we figure out how we can unmute May. It's kind of metaphorical that we're having trouble getting to hear her voice, but we'll come back to you. Agnes, for you, when you were listening to Lucy, you're French. How did you end up doing this kind of work, and what do your friends and family and others think about what you do, and how do they imagine it?
Thank you, Sanam. Of course, I cannot compare my situation with that of Lucy's. I grew up in a small village in the south of France, in a lower middle class family, very committed to our education. Nothing of the kind of drama that Lucy just described. But there were things that resonated with me, not the role of the mother per se. At least my mother was a role model for me. She was always very much into social justice. She was a school teacher and committed to public education, committed to children, and did a lot of work in the nonprofit sector. But what resonated with me was Lucy's comment about having been a revolutionary at an early age, because that was also very much my case. I got into very conflicted relationship with my father, with any kind of patriarchal system imposed on me. I became a feminist much later, so my anger was very much a guts thing. It became an intellectual and a political project in my late 20s. I was not an early bloomer when it came to feminism. So my mother, my grandmother were very big role model for me, their commitment to social justice, to people, their love for people. My family grew up, I was raised in a family that was very much committed to remembering the war and remembering what happened during World War II. My grandfather was someone who joined the French Resistance. Mm-hmm. He became one of them, a very committed fighter in the French Resistance, and he was captured by the Nazi and then executed on the more or less the last day of the war, on the 15th of August. And when I grew up, almost every year that I can remember, on the 15th of August, we will go to the place where he had been killed with two other men. And it was a moment of remembrance for the war, for the victims, for the Holocaust. Remembrance of him as a fighter, and of all those young men who had lost their life fighting for their freedom and their countries against occupation. So what Lucy is talking about is resonating with me at a subliminal level, because I've never experienced it, but it is certainly, it's a story that is part of me. You know, the fight for what you believe in, the fight for your people, for your values and for your countries. That is very much who I am, and it is part of my childhood, of my education, of my family.
It's fascinating, and I don't know whether May has been able to reconnect. She was having trouble with her connection. May, are you with us now? Can we hear you?
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay, fantastic. May, for you as well, I'm just curious about kind of how you got involved in activism. You've set up a number of networks in Myanmar. You work on issues of prevention of violence against women, but also around the bigger political issues of dictatorship. How did you get involved in this work? And you know, what's your story in terms of the calling that led you to this?
Yeah, I mean, growing up as a religious and ethnic minority woman, I am a Gachin Christian, and I have, of course, you know, firsthand experience of our intersectional discriminations that women of Myanmar face. I mean, this has been, you know, compounded with the toxic, militarized masculine culture, which its deep-rooted patriarchal norms that allow a very limited space for women's rights and gender equality. And people in Myanmar, they have been brainwashed that Myanmar women have high status and there is no violence against women in Myanmar. You know, that's quite funny. Why there are no dramatic gender discriminatory practices, you know, like such as female genital mutilation, wife banning, and female infanticide. Of course, you know, Myanmar falls short on many fronts of gender equality indicators. So, I mean, gender inequality index, you know, 0.478 rank 147 out of 187 countries. And maternal mortality rate is the highest in ASEAN. And I mean, according to the Inter-Parliamentary Union data, before the coup, you know, I mean, back in February 2019, in terms of women's representation in parliament, I mean, Myanmar is the second lowest country in Southeast Asia, but people are still, I mean, talking about Myanmar women have, you know, like equal rights and there is no discrimination. I mean, these situations have drawn me into this work and to advance gender equality and inclusions in the political and peace arena in a militarized and patriarchal country, you know, of course, yeah.
Thank you. And it's interesting, all three of you implicitly tie the issue of patriarchy and kind of patriarchal oppression with that broader political, militarized occupation, dictatorial things. I want to come back to you in terms of the work that you were doing as special rapporteur. You mentioned very specifically that in one of your reports that you were keen on bringing a gender lens to the work and that you were grateful to Asma Jahangir, who'd brought it before to this work. What does that mean? I mean, what does it mean to bring a gender lens into the work around these extrajudicial, this type of sort of issues? What were the challenges in dealing with the governments and the states that you had to kind of contend with? How are they, and do you think that mandate is continuing? Will that gender lens stay with you out of the job?
Thank you, Sanam. You know, it may sound strange to us to argue that in 2021, my mandate needed a gendered perspective, but it did. And that, I think, is a very important reflection of how far we've gone in terms of engendering the human rights framework, but also how much more needs to be done. My mandate, extrajudicial killings, is a very, first of all, it's one of the oldest mandates, mid-80s. It is a mandate that has been very masculine in its understanding. It was raised and emerged out of a certain historical perspective, you know, what happened in the Latin America, the dictatorship regime and so on, the disappearances, the killings, many of whom victims were men. And therefore there was a very public dimension to the extrajudicial killing understanding. Asma Jahangir had already opened that boundaries by speaking about honor killings and by looking at killings of people on the basis of their gender, sexual identity. So for me, when I got the mandate in 2016, it was an absolute commitment that as a second woman special rapporteur, I had to continue our work and to really push for understanding arbitrary killing from the standpoint of women's experience of life and death. You know, from a feminist standpoint, we are all aware that the human rights framework was very much founded on the understanding of a certain experience. It's a male experience, it's a masculine version of the world of public versus private, of what matters, what does not matter. So when I had the opportunity to unpack my mandate, the first thing I did was to try to analyze arbitrary killings from the standpoint of the experience of women of life and death. What does it mean? You know, and how does the human rights framework reflect their life and their death? And of course, it meant taking into account or opening the possibility that forms of domestic violence, when they lead to death, could be a form of arbitrary killings, but also looking beyond that. So many women die giving birth. You know, how do we reflect that? Isn't it a form of at least arbitrary death? And possibly arbitrary killing, that was I was asking. And what about women dying because they don't have access to safe abortion? Because governments are putting in place laws and policies that make it an absolute crime to seek an abortion, even when you could die from giving birth. Isn't that a form of killing? Governments know that when they put in place those laws, women will die from it. So considering that they have the intention to do so, for me, it was a form of arbitrary killing. And that's what I wanted to do with that mandate. I wanted to open the eyes and to open perspective that actually governments can kill even when they don't pull a trigger, and they can kill women through their laws and their policies. That's what I, you know, that's what I wanted to do. That's what I tried to do throughout my mandate. And I, many others have done it, and many others will continue to do it. And I like I said, I relied a lot on ASMA's opening the door for me.
That's fascinating. Lissy, you were listening to Agnes, and I was thinking about our conversation the other day about, you know, a day in the life of living under the occupation. For a young woman, for a young man, what is it like? Well, you know, from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m, how would you explain what the occupation actually looks like? And both what Agnes was talking about in terms of the private and the public intersection of abuse and violence or discrimination that you come across, you know, sort of in these different spaces and in the different ways. This, when we say structural violence, you know, whether it's water, whether it's checkpoints, whether it's education, what is it? Yeah, give us an example of what life under occupation can look like for people who've never been there and have never understood it.
Simply, I can say that we are living in big prison. We call it not Palestine, we call it Bandustan, which means after what we call it the peace process, we got only few land here and there, and it became like a Swiss cheese, which is really totally divided in between the districts. Now we have 11 districts. I live in Bethlehem. Very simple example, when I used to do my master degree, I did it at Bir Zeit University, just to give you like a hint. In the morning, I woke up, I go to want to wash my face, the simplest, especially summertime. There is no water in the tap, no water. Who controlled the water? Israel controlled the water. Okay, next, I want to travel to the university. I'm not allowed to go through Jerusalem because I am Palestinian. I have a green ID, which doesn't allow me to cross the checkpoints without having this permission. The permissions from where I need to get it, I need to get it from the Israeli authority. The Israeli authority won't give you that permit easily, only due to some fees, and if you are lucky to get it or not, and some for some medical treatments. So I need to take the other way, which is through the 67 roads, which led me to Ramallah, to Birzeit University. Regularly, it will take like 1 hour, 1 hour, 30 minutes, a drive. But due to temporary checkpoints, flight checkpoints, it takes me 10 up to 12 hours to go to the university and come back to my house. I get these questions from lots of international friends. Why you are doing that to yourself, Luz? You could be away in some of international countries and you could do it easily 1 year and come back. No, this is part of my resistance. In order to exist, you have to resist. By education, by non-violence means, when the soldier will stop the car and started to checking and taking my ID and put me aside, I'm using the non-violence way to resist. So this is an example of how it looks like. Another example, I come to the work early morning at 8 o'clock. We as a center, as a WAM center for conflict resolutions, basically the work that I'm doing, working with women. Women empowerment, women development, education, peace building, equity, changing laws, and we reach to the laws that you started to talk about, Agnes, which is about the penal code, abortion, customary law. All that laws, it's discriminated the women rights. So what we do as a center with other networks, civil society organizations, working on changing laws, advocating for our cause, being in the street, being in front of the judicial court, against honor killing, against some articles of the penal code that we need to change it. So this is that kind of the work that I'm doing. So when we come to the work and again hitting the road from way to way, just an example, before Wednesday, it was Wednesday, I was giving a training on gender equity in one of the villages in North Hebron. And on the way back, it was really a mess with thousands of cars on the road, due that the settlers is attacking the cars, attacking also the Israelis policemen, because they are building a road and they found out that there is some of the renovation of cemetery, and they consider it this cemetery for their ancestors, so they want to stop it. So the road was really blocked. Instead of taking me 1.5 hours, it took me 8 hours to go and come back to the office. Dead tired. So simply, when we are talking about human rights or living under occupation, there is no, all our rights being violated, from freedom of expression, from a freedom of movement. I'm not allowed to be in Jerusalem, which is 15 minutes drive from where I live, but I can travel to be in the States or to Japan through Jordan. So this is just a freedom of worshiping. So basically you can say that no rights for us, our rights being violated, but what shall we do? Shall we be silenced for that and accept the way how we are living? No, definitely. So in order to exist, you have to resist. There is no voice, Sanam.
I was just saying, in order to exist, you resist, and by simply staying there and wanting to remain and work and live and try and have an ordinary existence with your family and friends in your own land, that in and of itself becomes a form of resistance, and it's courageous because they don't want you there.
Yes, I didn't mention that the office located, it's really in hot spot. And we, why we choose that place, because we said this is part of our steadfastness. It's just in front of the separation wall and the Tower of the Israelis. And it's really hot spots. Many times they showered us with tear gas, with skunk water. Remember when I told you I was sick from the skunk water? So this is the way of living. So you don't know what will happen to you in any minute.
And just to clarify, skunk water is something they spray on you, which smells forever, for a long time.
And it's chemical. It's stick for 1 month minimum.
Thank you, Lucy. May, we heard, you know, in February, all of a sudden, all of a sudden, a lot of people knew or anticipated that something bad was going to happen in Myanmar. Can you just give us a little sort of insight into what life has been like for you, both in terms of your work and the activism and the decision that you had to make to leave? What happened? What have you been going through?
Well, I mean, this may have been the harder decision I have made in my life. Along with many women peace builders, you know, we have to relocate to resist and guard our hard-won space and to defend the gains we have made this for. So as for survival strategies, you know, considering that the situation has become basically unbearable, women peace builders had to leave the site of violence.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. But our commitment and activism to resist, to assist people in need and transform the situation is very much alive in Myanmar. We might have left the country physically, but our minds, hearts and souls survive for the liberation of Myanmar from this authoritarianism and tyranny of the regime. And we desire the realization of a federal democratic country that respects human rights for all. And women's groups have mastered their effort to establish, you know, two national hotline and helpline dedicated for women and girls who suffer the conflict-related sexual violence and violence related to their activisms and protests. And one umbrella women's organizations carry out a rapid need assessment, and another alliance documents the cases of conflict-related sexual violence, while others work on emergency relocations for high-risk individuals and digital security capacity development. And we very much appreciate, you know, all the assistance given thus far. Yet despite all the international rhetoric on the importance of the protection pillar within the WPS agenda, which prescribes women and girls' rights, safety and security must be protected in times of conflicts like us. Mm-hmm. But one thing we learned from the Myanmar experience is that women of Myanmar discovered a huge protection gap as they try to flee the sites of violence, arrest, and intimidation. Relocation funds are hard to come by for women human rights defenders, and applying for an urgent visa to take a refuge in foreign country is not impossible, but extremely difficult. Political asylum seeking process represents significant amount of barriers and difficult challenges. I mean, currently available urgent funds take at least a month to assess, which is not practical for someone needing to relocate in just days. And demand for safe house outstrips the supply when the gender deploys massive raids and arrests nightly. Women in the subnational level and ethnic areas face greater risks and protection needs. Many women human rights defenders have had to flee and go into hiding as their lives are in danger. Support for relocation of individuals does not seem to make much sense, given that women defenders and peace builders have family duties that they cannot easily abandon, you know, including care for minor and elderly dependents within the family. I mean, these people should also be given protection. This is a huge unmet need within the WPS agenda. and steps need to be put in place to cover this gap. And we need flexible and emergency funding mechanisms, you know, have to be truly flexible and responsive for those who have no saving or financial capacity to upfront their relocation expenses. These above mentioned needs are gender practical needs, right? Mm-hmm. And they are also the strategic needs, you know, for assistance from the international community to stop the humanitarian crisis of IDPs and protect their human security and dignity. You know, they need COVID-19 pandemic support through CSOs and ethnic health organizations and pressure on Myanmar neighboring countries to be responsible to the growing humanitarian crisis. Chin, Kachin, Karen, and Karenni and Burma refugees, you know, in the Zagayan region are facing a need for safe accommodation, access to health. International community should end an arms embargo on the State Administrative Council regimes, you know, coordinated list of prohibited items created by the countries that support a federal democratic Myanmar. And there is a need to ensure that the regime does not access the technologies for surveillance and repressions against democratic forces. You know, I mean, the UN Special Envoy's role remains important, of course, and the international community must ensure that the ASEAN carry out its influence with a political will that is willing to promote the building of a democracy with other regional actors who have access to the regime. And, you know, like, I mean, according to the Charter 2007, you know, ASEAN is supposed to be pursuing democratic forms of governance, rule of law, and the attendant fundamental human rights. Therefore, you know, their non-interference policy must be a secondary priority. So, I mean, I'm sorry to be so emotional, but things are quite unbearable in country. And I left my family behind in the country.
May, I'm so sorry. I wish we were together, and I hope that people who are listening understand the toll that it takes on individuals in terms of what you are going through and what you're fighting for, which is not just the present, but it's also for the future, for the next generations, and how much of a burden of responsibility you're taking. And where and how, you know, little, when we think about power, how little power activists have and how much responsibility they take. And yet, as you say, what are the regional organizations doing? What is the international community doing to uphold the norms and standards? Yes, I'm going to come to you with sort of a two-part question. One is that during your time as the special rapporteur, I mean, you had some of the most high profile cases imaginable to deal with. You dealt with the Khashoggi killing, you dealt with the Soleimani assassination, you dealt with the case of Alex Navalny, you dealt with the, you went to Egypt, you dealt, looked into the death of Mohamed Morsi, you dealt with Syrian journalists. I mean, you were dealing with very high cases that were prominent, but also, you know, on every level, governments that are powerful. What was it like? What kind of threats, what kind of personal burdens were you carrying and I know that perhaps some of these things you can't even mention in terms of the confidentiality that may go along with these cases, but what was it like as a on the individual personal side? And I asked this because last time I was interviewing Fatou Bensouda, the ICC chief prosecutor, and she was saying how the sanctions impacted her personally. And how, instead of it being institutional, that she's the chief prosecutor of an international organization, there was a personal kind of attack. Have you experienced some of that? What's it been like for you on in terms of just the personal dimensions and the toll?
Thank you, Sanam. I wanted to acknowledge May before because what she said touched me a great deal, because when we as members of mainstream large human rights organization, we do have a lot of relationship with human rights defenders including inside and outside their countries. I think what is often forgotten, including by the media and by the way we talk about it, is the trauma and the pain of living, is the trauma and the pain of going into exile, of leaving behind everything. And I think May's made reference to our elderly parents, and I could so relate to that because I take care of my dad. And, you know, I can't only imagine the pain of not being able to go back and to hold their hands. And I think it's a very important part of the story that we need to recall. It's about fighting and resisting, and the pain of leaving the exile, the creation of a new home, a far from home, you know, it's not possible really. And I've heard that story over and over again, and every time it touches me enormously. I just wanted to acknowledge that. In terms of your question, you know, I mean, compared to what May just described, what are the costs? Yes, a number of governments really don't like me at all. One of them at least made a public threat, death threat. I suspect a few others think the same. I will not travel to a number of countries, or I will not even fly, you know, have a flyover or change of plane in a number of countries. So I need to be careful. That's a cost of small cost of my involvement. I have not had any, unlike the ICC prosecutor that you were mentioning, I have not been sanctioned personally. And let's recall that she was sanctioned by the United States, which I think we need to highlight that she was sanctioned by the United States government personally for doing her job. So no, I haven't had that kind of experience. I had to take precautions for myself and for the people I work with and for the people on whose behalf I was doing my investigation. The costs were very light so far, touch wood. You know, I mean, I really do mean it. It doesn't matter. You know, I cannot go to Saudi Arabia, too bad. You know, it's not the end of the world.
Thank you. No, thank you. And thank you for mentioning the cost of living in exile and the family issues. For me, it's been 40 years of I've gone back and forth to Iran. But yeah, I had the same story with my father, and it is beyond painful when you think about it, for no reason whatsoever, other than they are afraid. I don't know what they're afraid of people like us. One of the things that we keep circling around for everybody is that we're working through the norms of the rule of law. You know, Lucy, you talk about the occupation being illegal. May, you talk about the importance of changing the laws. You know, now at Amnesty, in terms of upholding human rights laws and norms, and of course the as your role in the special rapporteur's role, it's about the rule of law. But we seem to be living in a time when laws don't seem to matter. I don't know whether, you know, maybe we're just becoming aware of this, whether it was like this, you know, always, and we just had a blip for a few years where it seemed that international norms were important. But Lucy, and I want to come back to you, Lucy, on this, that, you know, we saw the first intifada in the 1990s and the Oslo peace process that was meant to give us or meant to give you some relief, and yet where are we now? You know, what do you see coming forward? Where do you, as an activist, first of all, what do you want from the international community? But also on the ground, how do you see the changes in people's attitudes and respect for norms of systems and structures? And as I say, sort of, you know, the idea of human rights when it just doesn't exist for you on the ground.
The idea, we'll start from the end, the ideas of the human rights. I think because we don't have, and we have all the rights, but we don't, there is no implementation or or all our rights being violated. So if you don't have the space to express, and now I'm talking about both sides, the Israeli authority and also the Palestinian authority, when we don't have that freedom of expression, and this is another right. So basically we are calling rights, but it's been backward, not forward. And what's happening on the ground, and that I will talk about the Palestinian case, because we have lots of internal conflict and also external. When it comes to internal and external, yes, we have the occupation. Internal, when we decided we want to have the election for the Legislative Council, where the laws being written on the ground. So Legislative Council being expired long time. And when we decided as a Palestinian, we want to have it. Israel, they didn't allow the people that they are living in Jerusalem, the Palestinian people that they are living in Jerusalem to vote, which is, there is no rights. And also we have the population of the Palestinian, they are living inside Palestine, is the same of outside. When we are talking about allocating displacement, refugees, we have almost the same amount of outside the country. So there is no practice for the rights on the grounds, the human rights being backwards. The changes, it should be globally, acting locally, but unfortunately, what we acting, it's totally different. There is no rights.
I'm going to press on this. So, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, a generation that's growing up right now in Palestine, and seeing effectively the hypocrisy, right, that we have UN resolutions and all these statements and so forth about occupation, but it's not making any difference. There is outright impunity. I mean, the settlements are still going on, that the taking of people's homes and territories and just land is carrying on. What are people's attitudes towards global powers or towards the UN system or towards this idea of an international community? How is it perceived?
Well, to be honest, before we have a faith in the globe that they can put pressure on Israel or uphold Israel for the violation or for the action against the Palestinian. We used to look forward to have the UN resolutions that we adopted as a Palestinian on the ground, because we think it will help us on the ground. But actually what's happening, it's totally different. Israel, they are using any carte blanche. We'll tell you an example. When the war happened on Gaza, I think in 2008, the UN sent a rapporteur to Goldstone, and they wrote the reports, and they are back to the UN. What Israel did, either or, Goldstone, or you will get the money for the people, the Palestinian people, to survive. They know how to grab the chances. So yes, we want Goldstone, but also we want the Palestinian people to survive.
And this is, you're saying that they withheld the taxes or resources that were directed for?
Yes, there is what kind of resources? Israel control all the resources. Why they are hitting Gaza? Because they have gas. When we are talking about the money, I mean the tax, because we as Palestinians, we pay two taxes, for the Israelis and for the Palestinians. The Israelis will return the tax to the Palestinians, so they hold the money on the Palestinians until they grab a good chance for them to say either or, take it or leave it. So this is another issue. So when we are talking about Gaza, Jerusalem, what's happening right now in Sheikh Jarrah, and what's happening with another displacement of the Palestinians, we are talking about cycle of violence. Were those 28 families, which they are around 400, 500 people that they are living in these houses, why you want them to be away from their houses? To bring settlers from Russia or from Africa and put them, and they became the Aboriginal, they became the who settled in this land and they live in it, and we are the Aboriginals, we've been kicked out of from our houses. Tell me, where is the resolution, or where is the UN? Where is the human rights in that? What's the interfere of the international on that level? The displacement is continuously going from the 48, since 48, with the war started, 67, and we have around 522 villages being totally destroyed. Where is the people that they are living? So this is the displacement or the refugee that started from place to place. So those children, if we look from it as a psychosocial, what kind of trauma that they have? And, you know, I believe most of us as a Palestinian, we've been all of us traumatized from different experience. So how we could help our children to be treated from this trauma? We used to call it trauma healing, but we found out, no, there is no healing. Trauma coping. So they have to cope with the situation that they are living in. So education, raising children, education is really important on respecting, on accepting, on equity. So we have a faith in the new generations that the life of us will be totally different.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to come back to you on that. May, I want to come back to you on this question of the, you mentioned ASEAN's role and the international community. I mean, there, you know, we're also sort of all these, the events that are happening in Myanmar, in a way, it's like a sort of a moment where we're also seeing this evolution or the sort of emergence of this third sort of version of a new Cold War of the three, you know, China, Russia, and the US. And there's almost an assumption that Myanmar is in the sphere of influence of China, therefore basically the rest of the world really doesn't do very much about it. What do you think, first of all, what do you expect, and what should the world be doing? And secondly, if all of these countries are left behind, and yes, this is also a question for you coming in with the amnesty hat, if we begin to just say, oh, well, you know, that's their sphere of influence, and we're going to have authoritarianism in the other country over there, and we're going to turn a blind eye to what happens in Venezuela, and oh, yes, Afghanistan, well, that's gone, you know, all of these places, if they are left without this question of rule of law and justice and enabling dignity and safety and security for people, what are the consequences moving forward, both for the country, but also regionally and globally? So May, I'm just curious from your standpoint in terms of Myanmar, what do you hope for in terms of ASEAN, but also from the other global powers and forces that have leverage there? You know, maybe it's European companies, maybe it's all the oil companies and others who are making who are benefiting from Myanmar. What do you expect them, and what would you want them to be doing now?
Well, I mean, I'm really sorry to say that, you know, like, I mean, of course, Myanmar people, you know, who are suffering in country, you know, like, we have been quite disappointed with the international community, the UN, the ASEAN, and all the power games they are trying to play with, you know, our China and Russia, especially. So, like, and you know, how many more people are need to be dying, you know, like for their strong interventions, you know, on on our crisis. And all these atrocities happen, you know, because of military repeatedly getting impunity, you know, for the crimes against humanity they have done, you know, I mean, in the past 50 years. And I mean, this time, I mean, I don't know, you know, what the excuse for the war, for the international community and the UN, you know, like to let them escape, you know, another time from all the crimes they have done so far. So what we want, you know, like the international community is, you know, like, I mean, please, you know, come with the concrete actions, and we need stronger interventions, you know, more than statements, condemnations, and, you know, like, I mean, highly concerned or we condemn, you know, I mean, we need more than that, no? So like what military is mainly rely on is China, and I mean, Russia is helping them with technologies and, I mean, arms. So like we have to, the world have to put more pressure on China and Russia not to be helping these murderers, you know, to kill more people, I mean, who are innocent. And the military is totally rely on the revenues they are getting from oil and gas, especially, you know. So like, I mean, we civil society, with the strong support from some of our international friends, we have been sending letters to the Total company, you know, and all the oil and gas, I mean, big companies who are, I mean, investing in Myanmar, you know, not to pay taxes to the military, so that, you know, they may not have money to buy more weapons. And I mean, China, they just recently, I mean, publicly announced that they were going to continue their investment in Myanmar, you know, which is quite ridiculous, you know, like for all of us. And, you know, while people and younger generations, including children, are dying on the streets, and I mean, the military is shelling mortars and, you know, like indiscriminately shooting to everyone. But the world seems, you know, like, okay, I mean, ASEAN to intervene and, you know, like China to lead the negotiation, you know, which is totally impossible, you know, for us to accept. And ASEAN is, you know, like, how could they intervene to our country situation? You know, they themselves, a lot of the governments in ASEAN, they themselves are military government. And, you know, like, and how could they be neutral? Intervening Myanmar military to stop all these killing and human rights abuses, right? While they themselves are violating human rights in their own countries. So what we would like to say is, you know, like, I mean, why we have to rely on ASEAN, and why we are, I mean, our country's future and our future is decided by China and Russia. And we are living in the 21st century. And, you know, like, the world must not just sit back, relax, and putting our futures into the hand of ASEAN and China. You know, this is the message we would like to tell to the international community.
Thank you, May. And yes, so with your amnesty hat and the previous experience, so this question of China and Russia and where is the Western world, Europe, where is the United States, but also this mention of the oil and gas companies that are actually Western.
And
just to add to that, I mean, I was on a call not long ago with some British colleagues, and I said, you know, why does the British government enable the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia for the Yemen war? And, you know, one of the chaps turned around and said, oh, well, if we don't do it, China will. So this argument that if we don't, China will, it has become so stereotyped. as an excuse. But what do you say to that? To the fact that we have these major international oil and gas companies or other types of, you know, private corporations that are feeding or enabling. What can they be doing, and what should we be doing with the Chinas and Russias of this world from a democratic standpoint?
I think both Lucy and May have certainly well highlighted the paralysis of the multilateral system and its inability, incapacity, to play any kind of meaningful role. I mean, we are living in a system where the multilateral institutions are absolutely not fit for purpose. They are just not fit for purpose. And the paralysis of the system is having direct implications of life and death for many people around the world, whether it's because the Security Council cannot adopt any kind of meaningful resolution, or because China is bullying others in not adopting something at the Human Rights Council. I mean, it's just, you know, I have reached the conclusion in my mind that, of course, we still need to engage with those institutions, but we really need to start, you know, thinking of what will mechanisms fit for purpose look like. I think it's incumbent upon us to reimagine a multilateral system. It is now, you know, it was born out of Second World War. It has played a role. It has been, you know, it has done what it could, I think. It may be that it has reached the end of its due date, frankly. Now, of course, it's very difficult to argue that in a context where governments such as China and Russia are very keen as well to dismantle it. It's not just me who are saying it's paralyzed or ineffective. It's also all of the right-wing, fascist, anti-equality organizations that are come together very effectively, supported by a number of governments, to also attack the international system. So for people like me or us to want to rethink it, it's a very difficult moment because we don't want to play in the hands of all those terrible actors. But yet, I personally feel that given the fact that they are in any case so ineffective, we've got to start thinking of what kind of system do we need? What kind of institution do we need? What kind of mechanisms do we need so that there are some effective implications on the ground? So that's, I don't have an answer, by the way, but I just want to call on us, civil society, academics, let's reimagine a multilateral system fit for the 21st century. So that's the first thing. Now, Russia, China, the United States, they're all fighting, vying for power, buying influence, and so on and so forth. In many ways, we've gone through that in the Cold War, but it has a twist at the moment, I think. And the twist is that the relationship are very fluid. You know, it is very difficult to know to have a view of the world that is actually solid around influence and around ownership, I will say. So the instability of the system, either because it has not stabilized, solidified around one or the other of the superpower, or because it's not just the superpower fight. We're in the midst of a major climate, you know, upheaval, which is, you know, has enormous implications for humankind. We are in the midst of a new industrial revolution. This technology that we can't understand very well, but which is transforming every aspect of our life, including what it is to be human. You know, we are in the midst of, the last stage of capitalism, or I don't know whether it's the last of the, you know, but in any case, we know that at the moment, that too is not functioning. the inequality that has come in the in aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis has had tremendous implications for both on politics and on well-being. And the pandemic, COVID-19, has highlighted how bad the system was, economic, political, social. So, you know, nothing is stable at the moment. Everything is you know, it's very hard to find something to attach ourselves to and to say, that is solid, that is going to lead me into the next decade and I'm going to fight for it. But I will say, look, at the moment, we have we have us, we have the civil society organization, we have the activists, we have the people ready to leave their elderly parents behind, to continue resisting. We have people like Lucy who stay where they are to resist in spite of everything. We have we. And I think that's a formidable force. And no one has yet found a way of tap into it. Imagine those millions of people who over the last 12 months have gone into the street, have confronted armed policemen, have confronted the tear gas and the shootings. You know, this is a formidable force. Who wants good? How are we going to work with it? What can we do with it? And who is going to be able to bring us together so that we too can change the world? You know, we are actually changing the world a bit by bit. So, sorry, I don't have an answer for you, but I think, you know, I think in that world of uncertainty, our organizations, our associations, our commitment and courage to go into the street, the knowledge that actually it's not just us. Yes, the UN is frankly, you know, the ASEAN, China, but there is us. So how can we work together? How can we build far more effective alliance? How can we disrupt the paralysis so that it serves the people of Palestine and the people of Myanmar? I don't have an answer to those questions, but I know there are many people looking for it, with Lucy, with me, and with others.
Thank you. I think that's certainly my my observation and my inclination too, that it's as these big things are unraveling, you go back down to the local, and COVID showed us that when everyone else disappeared, the people who ran to the problem to help were actually women on the ground. And it's often women peace builders who are finding, you know, not being extreme, but finding, you know, radically moderate. You're trying to constantly find a new solution to engage and bring out the humanity in others. We have a few minutes left, and I have kind of one round and then one last question that I wanted to ask you. But one question, I wanted to bring it back to this question of as women in these spaces. I've been an activist for 25 years, and I've often found that being a woman can be a benefit if you know how to use the issue of how you disarm people sometimes, because they have, sometimes I used to say that people have such low expectations that the minute we come in and we start engaging, it changes their mind frame. But I'm curious, do you see that there, you know, is there a specific moment or experience where you think as a woman, human rights activist or human rights defender or peace woman, peace builder, that the question of gender identity matters and it's of value. It's not a constraint. It's actually a positive factor to be a female in these spaces. Lucy, do you have any thoughts on that? You're smiling.
Yeah. The first example, which is I remember that especially during the demonstration, during the demonstrations, they use the women to be in front when they have clashes with the security force. So they used to believe that when the security forces or the militant people, they will attack, they have a respect a bit for the women. So they don't attack the women. So that used to be before, in the first intifada, second intifada, but not anymore.
Not anymore.
Not anymore at all. So for the gender, there is no discrimination on a positive level. They used to actually, they gender, when it comes to gender, most of the time, the woman, that she is the one that the victim. I can bring you an example. Yesterday at the local council, we had like a a council for the water and the sewage committee. So I finished my period, and now they have to send another three councilors. Mm-hmm. So I was fighting. I was the first woman to be at the council there. So I told them that we should have this place for women. They said, no, we are not going to do that. Said, no, I started, and it should be continuous, that there is, women has to be represented there, because the issue of the water and the sewage is not for the men only, it's women, and the women, they can see it in different way. We had the clashes, they decide what they decide, and I decided that I will write a letter for the headmaster. So this, that kind, the only respect for a gender, maybe when you use public transportation, culturally, they have the respect. So the woman should be first.
So we have moved equality, equal opportunity, kind of in terms of violence being attacked, but still all these other discriminations. But again, you're there. You know, you haven't fought, you have not disappeared from the scene, right? So I think that there must be lots of Palestinians. I mean, in your own community, people must be looking up to you for what you're fighting for. Does that give you strength?
Yes, that's true. And even my mother used to be one of those women when the Israelis arrest some of the children in our neighborhood. So the neighbor would come and calling my mother, Imjad, come, the soldiers, they are arresting our children. So my mother used to go and start to have some of the conversation with the police in order to release the children. And she succeeded many times during that time.
Mediating with them. Thank you. May, for you, are there advantages, or have you been able to find advantages in terms of what you may be able to do your colleagues or the men that you may work with cannot do, or spaces that you may be able to occupy that is harder for men to engage with?
Sure. Yeah. But like Lucy said, I would like to start with some of the challenges, you know, like we have faced as a woman, you know, compared to men first. And, you know, like, of course, you know, when a man pick up his bag to join the revolution, you know, he is celebrated as a hero and gets the recognition, you know, that he has to abandon his family for the fight for freedom and justice. But if a woman does that, she is an irresponsible mother, wife, and daughter, according to Myanmar's prevailing social norms and expectations, right? So women peace builders face that gender challenge, I mean, time to time, and, you know, that include myself. But, I mean, women's groups continue to risk their lives and security, you know, to bring relief assistance to the affected communities in the form of medicines, food and non-food items, you know, shuttling messages, mobilization of humanitarian response, and alerting one another on arising needs. And, you know, safe houses are overrun by the survivors coming for help. And the local women's organizations are there to welcome and provide needed support to heal their GBV and, you know, conflict-related sexual violence wounds, pains, and trauma. And that said, you know, like monetary and psychosocial support continue to be of need. And as this crisis happens against, you know, like, I mean, at the backdrop of the COVID-19 pandemic, right? So many of our sister organizations are actively distributing COVID relief materials and gathering the intersectional human insecurities, you know, within the conflict context for advocacy with the global community. And I mean, one of the wonderful thing is, you know, in terms of women's role in peace building amidst war and conflict, I mean, like we formed the Women Human Rights Defenders Network as a symbolic spring revolution, you know. It's a 4-month-old daughter for all of us. And against all odds, I mean, she has been able to give voice to her demands, advocate for a global arms embargo, call for the release of those who have been detained, immediate stopping of airstrikes in ethnic regions, and challenge, you know, the tyranny of the present to be replaced by liberation, equality, and federal democracy. And the network has issued, you know, over 15 statements and a few position papers and open and closed letters targeting regional and international governmental bodies and human rights mechanisms for accountability and access to justice for survivors. And many advocacy briefings were done with concerned parties at regional and international levels, you know, where Women's Advisory Body was formed to give local and grounded situational updates and inputs to the global policymaking circle. And we will be continuing to participate in all these possible venues to raise awareness about what is happening in Myanmar. And I mean, domestically, you know, women peace builders have been mediating among different political forces. I mean, by being a constant reminder that all groups may have diverse views and strategies, you know, but our ultimate goal is building the federal democratic union that enshrines equality for all and freedom for all forms of authoritarianisms and discriminations, right?
Thank
you. Yeah.
Thank you. And yes, Amnesty International was, when I was involved in, when we were mobilizing to draft 1325 back in the 1999-2000, Amnesty was one of our key partners. Florence Martin was a colleague of mine at the time. I was working for with International Alert. And then Amnesty hasn't necessarily been part of the agenda as strongly in terms of the women, peace and security work. Do you see this, and as you listen to the stories of women peace builders, do you see it with your tenure that at Amnesty you're going to become more involved, or how do you see kind of the interaction of human rights and peace building work and the kind of this gender lens in the world of women?
It's at some level a complex question because my understanding of Amnesty International, you know, I've been back for two and a half months, that it does not conceive of itself as a peace building organization at all. And indeed, it does take a great pain to distinguish itself from the purpose of peace building. It's about justice, it's about accountability, it's about rule of law. And we know that in a certain conception of peace, peace and justice are not always going hand in hand very well. So that's the first thing I will say for Amnesty. Of course, it supports peace objective, but it does not mean that it sees itself as an ally necessarily in a peace building process, because it will insist on justice, even though it's increasingly looking at justice from a multiple standpoint and not just a judicial process. When it comes to gender and to women, you know, when I worked at Amnesty 20 years ago, my colleague and I were actually tasked with engendering Amnesty's work, which at the time was incredibly patriarchal and very masculine in its understanding of human rights. So with colleagues and who became friends, and I, we really fought very hard to ensure that gender women's rights were clearly integrated within the work of a human rights organization. It is there now. It's, I think, a journey that many other large old human rights organizations have done. It does not mean that we don't need to re-energize it and refocus it, and that certainly is something that I am, you know, I'm very committed to doing it. I should add that in the current context, as in any context, I think a work on women's rights is also a work on intersectionality. It's acknowledging that, you know, the intersection between race and gender, between ethnicity and gender, between age and gender. I mean, you know, I think we, you know, that's how Amnesty is understanding its work on gender and really trying to locate it within a racial and a vision as well for racial justice. which is something I fully support. And there will be many occasions to document, to report on, to denounce the what's happening to women in conflict situation and indeed in their peace work. So I'm here, and we, all of my colleagues as well, I know are very committed to that. So I'm looking forward to working with all of you.
And I'm sure we will definitely be in touch on both the big picture and these specifics. I'm going to end with one question, very simple question to all of you, which came in the chat, and it's something that I've been thinking about a lot as well, is that share with us what gives you joy and what makes you laugh and what just fills you up with the sort of the ability to carry on doing. But just that moment of what is it that helps you carry on and gives you joy in the midst of all the difficult issues you deal with. And I'll go around again. So Lucy, just any thoughts on whether it's music or whatever it is, it doesn't, yeah.
Well, music, sports, a smile from kids, appreciation from a woman that we work with, all of these bring us or strengthen our energy. Hope, we got the hope from people like you, people like ICANN, people who has put a print in our life in each step. People like ICANN family that during even all the period of COVID, we had lots of chat, we had lots of discussion, we had lots of love. Finding people that supporting our cause that bring us hope.
Thank you, and you're gonna make me cry now. So thank you very much. May, for you?
Yeah, so like to me is the unity we have, it has been 4 months now since the military controls the country, but women peace builders in country, we continue tirelessly strategizing and tackling the challenges, breaking down the barriers for their participation and integrating gender perspectives in newly formed governance bodies. And, we have a regular coordination meeting, the exchange of views in the forum of situation rooms where we can update each other on emerging forms of threats and early warning signs. And also we build consensus on political decisions, collective non-engagement with the regime. And all these strategizing meetings taking place after hours, oftentimes after midnight. And we have a very strong code, it is in Burmese, of course, but I would like to translate it to you in English, The code said, when your enemy wants you to die, trying to survive, not to die. It's also a revolution, So we are fighting a revolution for our children, for our country. To be a fair and equal democratic federal society for all, right? So we try not to die when the regime want us to die. This is our strategy, and this is our revolution. Thank you.
Thank you, May. Thank you. And yes, the last word is yours.
What gives me joy? My family, my friends, kindness, being with old friends and talking nonsense, really not talking politics, talking nonsense about life, about memories, about anything. And then what gives me joy, which is make me more political, is not to feel alone. What gives me joy is to know that there are people who have my back. What gives me joy is that there are people who will stand by me, who will stand with me, people who tell me, look, maybe what you just did now, what you just said was not great. There are, who will be putting me back on the right track. What gives me joy is the sense of community. even with people you don't know, they reach out to you through social media, through anything, and they said, thank you. You know, gives me a lot of joy as well to give my thanks. So let me do that now. Thank you very much to all three of you.
Thank you. And thank you all for this extraordinary conversation and for speaking from the heart. And I hope that for people who are listening and as the podcast comes out, please do share it. We'll be back with the next session in September. And I look forward to any ideas of people of issues you'd like us to touch on and speakers. But this session has been really extraordinary, incredibly moving. And thank you for all the work that you're all doing. Stay well, stay safe, stay joyful. And yes, solidarity, I think, keeps us going. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thank you all. Bye.